I wanted to review just a slide ever so little bit in the 16th chapter. We know that the last half of the book, beginning in chapter 12, is setting the stage behind the scenes for the things that took place in verses or chapters 1 through 11. And we know that this is climaxing into a battle between God and Satan, ultimately, at its beginning, essentially before time began, and certainly began as far as humanity is concerned in the Garden of Eden. And in our study, we are reading the pouring out of the bowls of wrath, and we've contrasted some of what we are studying in the 16th chapter to the 8th and 9th chapters with the sounding of the trumpets. We noted that with the sounding of the trumpets, there was warnings. We noted repeatedly a third part being destroyed. Here we see the wrath of God being poured out without bound. And we're discussing the pouring out of the sixth bowl. We've noted the first in verse 2, the second in verse 3. The third in verse 4, the fourth beginning in verse 8, and then the fifth poured out in verse 10 upon the throne of the beast, and his kingdom was darkened. They gnawed their tongues for pain, and they blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and they repented not of their works. Now that sets the stage for what I want to talk with you about in our study tonight. Or this afternoon. In verse 12, it says the sixth bowl, the sixth poured out his bowl upon the great river, the river Euphrates, and the waters thereof was dried up, that the way might be made ready for the kings, that they might come from the sun rising. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits, as it were frogs, for they were spirits of demons, working signs which go forth into the kings of the whole world to gather them together unto the war, the great day of God the Almighty. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked, and they see his shame, and they gather them together into the place which is called in the Hebrew Armageddon. Now that sets forth what we're going to talk about tonight. And of course, here's the verse 16 on the board. Keep in mind that Armageddon is a spiritual conflict beginning, as we saw in chapter 12. Satan and his allies are gathered to wage war against God and his saints, the kingdom of Christ and his disciples, as they've never done before, nor shall ever be. I want to note as well that we are given weapons that are spiritual weapons. They're very effective. In 2 Corinthians 10, verse 4, to the tearing down of strongholds, but we know that we're not talking about a physical battle. In John 18, verse 36, Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." In numerous studies, as we have examined Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 18, we are instructed to put on the whole armor of God that ye may be able to stand. And we note that the sword that is used as an offensive weapon and a defensive weapon is the word of God. And we're familiar with all of that. So we're not talking about a physical war. I don't know, Daphne, if you were in the class or not when we were in school together. There was an older lady in one of our Bible classes that was just absolutely terrified of being caught up in the battle of Armageddon. And when some of this was explained to her, it was just as a great relief to her that this battle is not, in fact, a physical battle. It is a spiritual battle. Now, Armageddon literally means hell of Megiddo. And Richard and I and some of you were talking about this from the Google Earth maps a little while ago. But we note that Armageddon, or the Hill of Megiddo, is derived from an actual place in the valley of, I call it Jezreel. Richard, you said I'd learned to pronounce that. How is it properly pronounced? Jezreel? Okay, Jezreel. Well, all of my 150 years of preaching, I've always called it the Valley of Jezreel. It's going to be awful difficult for me to change that now, but I'll try. Jezreel. But what we want to note is there's no literal hill or Mount of Megiddo. And this is what you were talking about a while ago as you were showing us, the maps of, what is perceived as a hill, which is not, it's kind of like Western Arkansas, the Ozark Mountains. And then you compare that to Mount Whitney over here. The Ozark Mountains are kind of a hill, to say the least, but be that as it may. There were a number of towns in this valley of Jezreel or Megiddo, and we can read about some of them in Joshua 17, Judges 1, specific towns that are mentioned. We can read about the waters of Megiddo in Judges 5, and we can read about the valley of Megiddo in these passages. But Mount Megiddo is not really a mountain, is it, Richard? It's a plain located between the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean Sea. And what we want to know about this is that since it is not discussed in the book of Revelation chapter 16 as an actual literal place, then we're not discussing an actual literal battle, but we're discussing a spiritual battle that's described here. This valley that Richard is going to show us in just a moment is actually somewhat triangular in shape. It's not a real huge area. It's about 20 by 15 miles in size. It's only about 6 miles across the valley due north from Megiddo. Megiddo overlooked the plain of Esdraelon and has been a strategic place in the history of God's people. And you'll see why as we look at some of the maps, and especially as Richard shows us from Google Earth, from current maps that we will look at. We note that what made it so important, it's on the main road between Egypt and Mesopotamia. And I want to show you a couple of maps relative to that before Richard takes us to Google Earth. But typically it is a battleground between the forces of good and evil. And that's what we're seeing in Revelation chapter 16. And that's why it's so important to our study. And that's why I'm persuaded that it's mentioned, the Battle of Armageddon. Barak and Deborah. I'm going to let you look these up. I don't think it's necessary for us to examine all of these in great detail. But Barak and Deborah overthrew the kings of Canaan in this battleground. You'll also note that in Judges chapter 6, this is where Gideon defeated the Midianites. And I love to talk about Judges chapter 6 and 7 in reference to Gideon and how that the Midianites were so great in number they were described as locusts. But that's where this battle took place. It's also where Saul defeated the Philistines in 1 Samuel chapter 31, specifically in verse 8. We're familiar with 2 Kings 9, where Ahaziah died as a result of Jehu's arrows in that context. So it has a place historically marked in our minds where a lot of things occurred. Pharaoh Necho overthrew Josiah in this battleground. So that's enough for us to get a feel for where we are talking about, and then this map identifying the trade routes, which those of you who are familiar with our history and geography study, you're familiar with this map. And if you can see my arrow, I'm going to assume that you can, you'll notice the dotted line coming down the coast. It comes through Megiddo, and then it goes on down through the plain of Philistia on the way to Egypt. This travel path was called the Way of the Sea, lower elevation coming through here. You'll note also then the Way of Shur, higher elevation as it came through Bethlehem and Jerusalem, and follows this path somewhere in this area, crosses over the Jordan River, and then continues on up to Damascus. Another very important trade route was on the Transjordan side, east of the Jordan River, called the King's Highway. This was a somewhat higher elevation. It was a plateau, but it represented a trade route that went down south. And we're going to zoom out just a little bit in our, well, before I do that, here we are. Zoom out just a little bit on this map, and you'll see where Megiddo is located. As soon as I get it on there, there it is, where it's located. Now, the thing that makes this map helpful to us is from these trade routes, if you're going anywhere that's important, if you're going down into Egypt, here into Africa, you're going to follow some of these trade routes. If you're heading from the northern portion north of the Mediterranean Sea from Asia Minor, coming south, you're going to go through these trade routes. If you cross over the Jordan and go over into the Arabian Desert, I don't know why you would, but if you did that, you're going to follow some of these trade routes. If you're coming from Mesopotamia, you're going to follow these trade routes either on the Transjordan side or on the western portion, either the higher elevation going through Jerusalem or the way of the sea, the lower elevation. But noting where Megiddo is, you're going to go through this area wherever you're going to go. And so who controlled this portion of real estate, controlled some of these trade routes? And looking at this one, you see, whoever controlled these trade routes controlled the trade around the Mediterranean Sea all the way over into the Arabian Desert, all the way over into Mesopotamia. So when we talk about Megiddo and these important battles that were fought here, there's a reason why they were fought here, to hold on to or to conquer land that people wanted to take over. And so that's why this is so important. Numerous Old Testament battles had been fought in this area. So it's not a surprise to us then when we're reading about it here in the book of Revelation of this representative spiritual battle between good and evil that this place would be mentioned. The battle that would reference the Valley of Megiddo. Now, Richard, I'm going to stop sharing my screen, and if you would expand on that just a little bit from your maps on Google Earth, get that up in front of us and show us what was recognized as the hill of Megiddo and why then it doesn't really represent in the book of Revelation a great mountain or, for that matter, a literal hill. It's referencing the strategic location of some of these battles that were fought. Now, he's got labeled on this map, the, as you see it at the top part, the Valley of Jezreel. And if you'll zoom in on that a little bit and then angle that a little bit, we can see that it really isn't a major hill. But this does, the map that you have right there helps us to see the travel paths that would come through this area and why then it's so strategically located.
I think you had a, so I think there was a river that was in this area somewhere.
Yes.
So, but if you come down and look at Megiddo itself, just zoom on down to it, this apparently where they've identified Megiddo, and this could be the ruins here, I suppose. But if we look at it at an angle here, we can see that though it's on a hilly area, it's not really much of a hill.
Yeah.
So it's just elevated just slightly.
Yeah. Now that's looking out west to the Mediterranean Sea. And you'll note the plain, as we described it earlier, it would make a wonderful battlefield. And no doubt, many battles were fought there as we've looked at the Old Testament text. And you see, going anywhere, coming from anywhere, you're going to pass through this. And militarily, you want to control this. That gives us an idea. And I think sometimes too much is made of this. But it helps us to see why that term is used in this context. Those who would be familiar with Old Testament history. And I think sometimes we miss this point too. We say, well, this book is addressed, to those who are Jews about the fall of Jerusalem. And this is evidence to that effect because there's a lot of Old Testament in the book of Revelation and the Jews would be familiar with the Old Testament. Well, that's true that Jews should be familiar with the Old Testament. But by this time that, we're reading of these things, keep in mind that this is written to the seven churches of Asia Minor, and the seven churches were not just made up of Jews, they were made up of Gentiles as well. And the Gentiles' knowledge of Old Testament prophecy and Old Testament text, let's not minimize it, because for their benefit, the Old Testament had been translated into Greek some 200 years before the time that Jesus came, in the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament scriptures. So to suggest that, well, we're talking about Gentiles who have become Christians and they would be virtually ignorant of all of this Old Testament history. I don't buy that. I'm not convinced of that at all. That doesn't warrant the conclusion that the only readers of this would be Jews. That's just not true. And so what we're looking at is to simply note the strategic location where many of these Old Testament battles were fought, and the significance of that as we bring this battle between good and evil to a climax here in this 16th chapter with the pouring out of the sixth bowl of wrath. Now, Richard, if you'll stop sharing and allow me to share again, I think that will serve our purpose in case somebody has a particular question about that. We can go back to it easily enough. Any comment or question just here? Okay. Well, remember that the book of Revelation is filled with symbolic language. And let's not get mixed up here and think, well, all of a sudden we're talking about a literal battle. If this scene is literal instead of figurative, then a lot of confusion exists. We see that the general appearance that's described here of this battle ongoing was as frogs. And you'll notice also in this text, it would be physically impossible for an army of 2 million horsemen to march in formation 1 mile wide and 85 miles long, as we see this described in this context and the following context. And you'll notice further in the following context that there's supposed to be a river of blood that would be some 200 miles long that wouldn't even fit in this valley because of the hills and such that would be the topography of the land. So this helps us to see that we're not talking about a literal battle. Now, many of you have, in times gone by, I know, had this argument with folks or discussion whether this Battle of Armageddon is a real ongoing physical battle that's someday going to be right before the second coming of Christ that would then usher in the 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth as a literal kingdom. No, this is talking about a battle between God and Satan, a battle that was fought and won by the Lord in the destruction of Rome, or the fall of Rome, as Rome is personified as the enemy of God's people. Now, we've looked at this passage several times in Revelation 19, verses 19 through 21, and I want to do it again in our study, and then go back and look again at Daniel chapter 7. So open your Bible to Revelation chapter 19 and read with me beginning in verse 19. In Revelation 19, verse 19, John writes, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat upon the horse and against his army. And the beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought the signs in his sight, wherewith he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. They too were cast alive into the lake of fire that burneth with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, even the sword which came forth out of his mouth. And all the birds were filled with their flesh." And look at the description of John concerning the results of this battle. He that sat upon the horse with his army defeated the beast and his army. Now hold that thought and turn back to Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, read with me, beginning in verse 11. In verse 11, Daniel said, I beheld at that time, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain and its body destroyed, and it was given to be burned with fire. And as for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Now, what is it that Daniel is prophesying about in Daniel chapter 7? The destruction of the beast. The beast would be cast into fire. Daniel in chapter 7 is talking about a specific beast, the fourth beast. You'll see that as he continues in verse 23, where there he said, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all the kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down and break it in pieces, and so forth and so on. This beast was allowed to have a place of rulership for a time and times and half a times, and then that judgment was taken away, and he would be consumed. Do we see that? Now, Daniel said in verse 28, here is the end of the matter. This is it. Now look at the words of John again, turning back to Revelation chapter 16. In Revelation chapter 16, we're going to come back to this with the charts, but to step ahead, you'll notice in verse 17 of Revelation 16, it says, and the seventh poured out his bowl upon the air, and there came forth a great voice out of the temple from the throne saying, it is done. It's done. Now what did Daniel say? Daniel didn't say it is done, but he said something almost the same. What did Daniel say? Here's the end. Here's the end of the matter. Now, did Daniel understand all of it? No. He said it troubled me. He didn't understand how this was going to take place. But did the prophets always understand the details that they prophesied? Well, no. 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 12 through the next few verses, tells us that these were things that the prophets didn't understand, as they reveal things concerning our salvation, even which the angels desired to look into. So Daniel, he doesn't understand the things that he's revealing about how that God's people are going to be vindicated. And John is revealing that. And John said, it is done. Daniel said, it is finished. Here it's done. Now, what is done? This great ongoing battle between good and evil that's personified with the Roman emperors and God's people, those who are identified as saints. What we are being assured of is that the saints will have the ultimate victory. And those who serve the beast and his image, they, along with the beast, will be cast into fire. And that's what Daniel prophesied. Now, does that make sense to anybody besides me? Now, here's where we get into problems.
Hold on.
Go ahead.
Jesus, when he died on the cross, said it is finished.
Yes. He was talking about something different, however.
Right, but he accomplished what he came to do.
That's right. Those things that the prophets had said relative to his work, it was done. It was done. Now, that raises some interesting questions, and I think that demand an answer. When Jesus said, it is finished, does that mean that everything that the Old Testament had to say had been brought to fruition? Well, No, we need to identify the context. Jesus said everything concerning him, everything pertaining to his work, everything pertaining to his crucifixion, it's done. His reason for coming had been finished. His death on the cross had shed the redemptive blood that would save us from our sins. And I think sometimes we make a terrible mistake when we look at one expression that has a context and say, well, every time that expression is used, then this is what it always means. That may or may not be true. Some of you may remember, and I'm getting off the subject here, but just to illustrate the point, some of you may remember back during the days when churches were dividing over the institutional question, the expression, all things or all men, I should say, all men, folks found passages where that expression, all men, and one in particular, the translation is from the Greek expression, eis pantos. Typically, pantos or some form of it is the word that is used. And I was in the audience one time where a fellow said, and I quote, every time that expression, eis pantos, is used in the New Testament, it always means all men, everywhere, no exceptions. And he cited a few illustrations that he thought defined the truthfulness of what he said. And that's just not so. That's an inaccurate statement. And you can see that as you would study Acts chapter 4, beginning in verse 32. We noted there that grace was upon them all. And those in that context is not all men everywhere, no exceptions. Or no exclusions, but great grace was upon them all. Who is great grace upon? Great grace is upon those who are baptized into Christ and benefited from his shed blood. The grace of God don't benefit anybody who's not baptized into Christ. When you read in Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, we learn that it is by faith that we have access into God's grace. What about the man over here who is an unbeliever? Is great grace upon him? Well, no. Now, if you make an expression or make a statement like every time this is used, it always means this. You choose two words that you'd better be sure of. And that is every time and always, because all I have to do is show one time that is the exception and your statement is false. So we need to be careful about using expressions like that. But such is the case here in our text. When we use expressions like it is done, it is finished, it is fulfilled, we need to see what it is. That needs to be defined because it likely has a context that's being discussed. And it may not always mean the same thing. Sometimes it might, but not conclusively. So having made that point, here's where we get into trouble. Modern day prophets. They sometimes say, well, this great battle that's prophesied here by John, the Battle of Armageddon, well, that's going to involve Russia and Israel and the United States. And others go farther than that. And some say this is a great war that's going to end all wars. And it's going to lead to the final return of the Son of God. And he'll establish his 1,000-year reign upon the earth in the literal city of Jerusalem. And note that John in Revelation 16, he's not talking about something that's going to take place at the second coming of the Lord. He's talking about something that's not ahead of us in history, but behind us in history, specifically when Rome fell and the prophecy of Daniel in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 came to pass. The oppression against God's people from that empire, the beast that's being discussed in the book of Revelation, came to an end. Any questions or comments just here?
Yeah, I have an observation that I've thought of every time I've looked at Revelation 16 and also Revelation 19, is that you see that they're gathered together at the end of verse 16 into the place in Hebrew called Armageddon. And then in verse 17, it says it's done. And then what we looked at in chapter 19, it talked about everybody gathered together and, you know, to fight and all that sort of stuff. And God just wiped them out. I thought, you know what? Even if this were a literal battle, it only lasts seconds. the armies that are gathered against God do not make any headway at all. They're completely defeated almost instantaneously. So obviously there's no time frame in these verses right here. But the fact of the matter is that this is not some sort of ongoing worldwide battle. It's something that God took care of right away.
Yeah. I heard a voice.
That wasn't near as exciting as what people are wanting to make it out to be. You see, this is dull.
Well, that's probably true.
you know, they've got in their mind that, that all this horrible stuff, and let's scare these people to death.
Yeah, yeah. And it's going to be something that's going to take a lot of time, and you're going to be caught up in it and all this stuff. And so you live your life in dread of some big physical battle when you need to live your life in dread of facing the wrath of God. That's the lesson we could take home from this because of continuing practice of sin.
You know, Mickey, you were talking about the lady who, when they first started looking at this, how afraid that she really is, now how she was at one time. But then now when she goes through it, she sees that that's something that happened in the past. It really makes a difference. But what really makes a difference is to continue, you know, to realize that, that God's going to win no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's When you see Russia, Israel, the United States, if you look around, that's changed because now China's in there.
Well, you know, one of the things that we've learned in our history and geography study is that the land masses stay the same, but the boundaries change. And so any kind of speculation on physical nations that's going to be involved in some kind of physical battle is just that. It's speculation. You don't know, even if you're using these as predictors of the second coming of Christ, you don't know who's going to be in control of those land masses, because you don't know when the second coming of the Lord is. Even the Lord doesn't know that, only the Father. And so to identify the nations that are going to be involved in some physical war is not only to miss the point of the passage and lift it out of its context, but it's pure speculation from the get-go. All right, any questions or comments here?
Yeah, I'll say something.
Okay, go ahead.
Carol and I were just noting that a lot of the false teaching, at least in our generation, was the television program Left Behind, which a lot of people saw. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people that they watched. I remember one time I was in the what was the Bible bookstore?
Kind of the Fish.
It was after that.
Oh, the Family Christian bookstore.
Family Christian bookstore. I was in there looking for a Bible one time, and they had that playing on their video screen, Left Behind, the Left Behind series. And what isn't it based on Late Great Planet Earth or one of those books?
Hal Lindsey stuff.
Hal Lindsey.
But it, you know, it showed people driving their cars, and then all of a sudden they're just taken. And their car crashes, but those are all the good people. But anyway, they it's an entire series of false doctrine that's supposedly based on Revelation.
Yeah.
I think too, this battle that some have in their mind, I think people have watched a few too many movies, and the newer movies, I mean, they're not brand new now, but our kids were watching them was, you know, The Lord of the Rings or when you read the Chronicles of Narnia or even the Star Wars, they have these epic battles. And I think a lot of people picture that. They think that that's somehow going to be the end of the world. And they've never studied it, and they just imagine all of these things.
Well, apocalypse, the way that word is used in modern day life, I guess, is associated with that kind of thing. Terrible, huge warfares and battles that take place. And the word apocalypse simply means an uncovering, an unveiling. That's what our word revelation in the first verse of this book means. It's an unveiling. And somehow folks have associated the word and its meaning to be some kind of horrible war. And the word don't mean that. It just don't mean that. And so we come away with a bunch of junk.
It seems like, you know, people that have imagined that or believe it because they, you know, listened to a false teacher, none of that can be reconciled with 2 Peter 3.
No.
You know, you read 2 Peter 3 and you can't come away from that thinking anything except the Lord's in control. On the last day, there won't be a battle. On the last day, there'll be judgment.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've said all I want to say.
Well, it's all relevant. So there you go. I appreciate your points. In verse 17, any other comments or questions? Yes.
I was going to say.
All right, Bruce and Glendale. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, I was just looking at when you were speaking about Megiddo, you know, how many battles and everything that were there. But also, a lot of those battles that, as you were saying, there were a lot of pharaohs that basically ruled those, you know, ruled those areas. I was just going over, you know, looking at Kings and the Book of Chronicles and the Book of Judges.
Well, it's a strategic location. A lot of battles fought there. Did I hear Glendal?
Yeah, you do. Yeah, the answer, you know, to these futuristic ideas is in Revelation 1, verse 1, where he said,
"Oh yeah,
to reveal things shortly, and will shortly come to pass."
Yeah.
So that's something that's going to happen years later.
Well, the book begins that way and it ends that way. Revelation 22, verse 6, again, these words are faithful and true. The Lord God of the spirits of the prophets sent his angel to show unto his servants the things which must shortly come to pass. And then he said, "Behold, I come quickly." So, yeah, he's not talking about something that is discussing the second coming of Christ thousands of years from the time that John wrote. Any others?
Yeah, Mickey, along with what else I was saying is also the area which you're talking about with low hills, and those were the worst places to even have a battle.
Well, perhaps so, but a lot of battles did take place there. And I think the reason is because of these travel ways. It was very strategically located.
They said they were pretty bloody when they had them.
Pretty bloody, yes, no doubt. In verse 17, it says, "And the seventh poured out his bowl upon the air, and there came forth a great voice out of the temple from the throne, saying, It is done. And there were lightnings and voices and thunders, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since there were men upon the earth, so great an earthquake, so mighty. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the great was remembered in the sight of God, who give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath." Now let's pause and talk a little bit. The seventh poured out his bowl upon the air, and there came forth a great voice out of the temple. Now we've looked at this expression "out of the temple" before. Where is the voice coming from? And don't say "out of the temple." What does this represent? The voice came from God. It is done. Here is the authority of God represented in this statement. It is done. It's finished. It's through. The judgment has been completed. Now, those who want to say, "Well, we've got a literal something taking place here, the little air smitten." No, that's not the point. You know, in Ephesians chapter 2, Satan is referred to as the prince of the powers of the air. That fits the context of the things that we're talking about. This final bowl of divine wrath is poured out upon Rome. The voice came from heaven to pronounce this wrath. And here's what we see indicative of that. There were lightnings and voices and thunder, a great earthquake. And let's not make too much of this expression, "such as was not since there were men upon the earth, so great an earthquake, so mighty." Some read this and say, "Well, this earthquake was greater than any that ever came before and greater than any that ever came after. And the lightnings and the voices and all this was greater than anything that had ever been done ever before." And so this great city must be talking about some physical city, rather than to be talking about the fall of the beast that's identified as Rome, or this expression "Babylon the Great," therefore must be talking about the city of Jerusalem. And we'll have more to say on that in just a little bit. But what we want to note is that God would pour out the cup of his wrath, the fierceness of his wrath upon Babylon. The nations would fall. The cities of the nations fell. Now, whoever Babylon is, I don't believe that we can identify this as one particular city, because he's talking about the cities of the nations fell. We're not talking about a physical battle, as we've just discussed. We're talking about a spiritual battle. So how do we have a major city in particular fall in a spiritual battle. That's not the context. Now, I want us to note back where this expression is used and see how it has been used in the book of Revelation. In Revelation 11 and in verse 8, we read of this great destruction. And it says, their dead bodies lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. Some say, see, right there, we're talking about the city of Jerusalem. Well, we've talked about that and elaborated on it when we studied Revelation 11 and verse 8 and noted that Jerusalem is not the only city that is referred to as Sodom or Egypt or as Babylon. And we're going to notice that as we continue our study in Revelation chapter 14 and in verse 8. That 14th chapter as a whole was very, very significant because we saw there in verse 8, a second angel followed saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the great that hath made all the nations to drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And we saw that term Babylon used concerning the city of Nineveh and others in the Old Testament. Now somebody said, well, it's also used in the Old Testament in reference to the people of God, Jerusalem, or the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel. That's true. It's true. But to say that it's exclusively used relative to Jerusalem is a misstatement. In verse 10 of the 14th chapter, you'll note that a third angel followed, and he said, if any man worshipeth the beast in his image and receiveth a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he also shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared unmixed in the cup of his anger, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels. Well, first I want you to notice the similarity between Revelation 14 verse 10 and what we're seeing here in 16 verse 19. We're reading about the pouring out of God's wrath. And in Revelation 14, his wrath was poured out on the beast. His wrath was poured out on those who worshiped the beast and received the mark of the beast. And in this chapter, we see that Babylon is the one that is identified as the recipients of the fierceness of the wrath of God that would be subject of his wrath. In 16 verse 20, it tells us that every island fled away and the mountains were not found. Well, let's again go back in the writing of John here in the book of Revelation in the 6th chapter and note in verse 14 where the writer says the heaven was removed as a scroll when it is rolled up and every mountain and island were moved out of their places and the kings of the earth and the princes and the chief captains and the rich and the strong and every bondman and free man hid themselves in caves and in the rocks of the mountains. And they say to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us, hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath is come, and who is able to stand? Now, someone says, well, we know that the wrath of God was poured out on the city of Jerusalem. That's true. Matthew 24 describes that. And those who were the inhabitants of the city of Jerusalem were told to flee to the mountains. That's true. We read about that in Matthew chapter 24. But to suggest that this is the only time that this has reference to any such judgment taking place is just not accurate. In Ezekiel, for example, in chapter 26, notice with me in verse 18, Ezekiel chapter 26 in verse 18, there the writer says, now shall the isles tremble in the day of thy fall. Yea, the isles that are in the sea shall be dismayed at thy departure. The islands fled away. Let me ask you, in Ezekiel chapter 26, what island is being described as being destroyed? Tyre. Yeah. So notice, if you will, that this expression, the islands fleeing and the mountains not found, these expressions are not necessarily exclusive to the fall of Jerusalem. These are expressions of judgment. upon a city, upon a nation. And that's what it is here. And in the context of Revelation chapter 14, 15, and 16, it's my judgment that he's talking about the fall of Rome. Now, as the thought continues in verse 21, it says, "In great hail, every stone about the weight of a talent cometh down out of heaven upon men. And men blasphemed because God, blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail. For the plague thereof is exceeding great." Now, notice, if you will, in the comparison that we have of the sounding of the trumpets in Revelation chapter 8 and what we're reading here, lightning, thunder, great earthquake, nothing else like it. What we want to note is that this represented the destruction of Judah at the hand of Nebuchadnezzar in Ezekiel chapter 5. It does represent the fall of the Jews at the hand of Titus, the Roman general, in Matthew chapter 24. But what we note concerning the language is it represents what we've called the epitome of horror of God's judgment. You see it in Revelation 8. You see it here in this text, and you see it in other places in Old Testament history as well as in the New Testament. Now, you'll see some of this represented in the plagues upon Egypt, as we've looked at concerning other charts. The point being is it represents in Revelation 16 the judgment of God and the rejection of God, the refusal of these people to repent. And so now God's judgment is certain. And that's the point that I want us to see. And if you'll indulge me just a moment, I want to get through this point, and then I'll close. What we see is the completeness of destruction. All nations fell who were in league with Rome and in opposition to God. What we want to note is they were weakened and divided, and they were easy for God to conquer. There was no place for refuge. Even the islands, and I think when we read about Tyre and their boast before Alexander the Great, that becomes a subject that we could elaborate on. There was not a place to get away. You run to the mountains, you run to the islands. There's no place to get away from the judgment of God. And so the cup of God's wrath and all of its terror was poured out upon these who were the subjects of the empire and worshiped the beast and received the mark of the beast. Now, I've talked long enough. Anybody else have a question or a comment pertaining the 16th chapter?
Nick?
Randy?
We were also commenting that it's interesting the way the language is in here, and throughout the entire chapter, it's spelling out, you know, step by step through each angel and their bowl of wrath. And when you get to the end, it's complete destruction.
Yeah.
But when it talks about nations and cities, you're just saying that, you know, the Roman Empire was an empire.
Yeah.
Rome was not a nation. Rome was an empire.
They collected nations.
They collected nations. You know, it was their collection of nations, and those nations had cities. But when Rome fell, all of Rome fell. All the nations fell. All the cities fell. That was the end of the empire. And that's what we see here, is total and complete judgment.
I think your point, Randy, perhaps has some, what's the word I'm searching for? Grander? It's bigger than just that. Because in my mind, at least, it helps me to understand that he's not just talking about one city.
Right.
He's not just talking about the city of Jerusalem, for example. Now, granted, Jews from all nations under heaven gathered in the city of Jerusalem for the observance of those feast days, Passover and Pentecost. But Jews scattered out over the globe, as it were, from those nations that are represented there in Acts chapter 2, does not represent the control of Jerusalem of the nations. When you think of the empire of Rome, it did.
Yeah.
So. Well, it occurs to me that we had the city of Babylon in the Old Testament, But everything it's referring to here says Babylon the Great. And I think, I believe somewhere here in Revelation, Babylon the Great was described as spreading out over many waters and covering a lot of territory.
Yes, we'll get into that the next chapter. Yeah.
So that's sort of important too.
I think that
indicates the Roman Empire, as Randy was saying, rather than just
it's bigger than a city.
Rather than just Rome.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. I think that's a valid point. Any other comments or questions?
I think it just shows the complete and utter destruction, God's judgment. I mean, it's complete when he makes his judgment. And he gives man an opportunity to repent, but no, he's not, or God is long-suffering, but he's not forever suffering.
That's right.
Comes to an end after a while.
Well, let me ask for just my own personal information's sake. In our study, is the book of Revelation making more sense than perhaps we thought when we first anticipated studying it? Are you finding that it is really not as complicated and as complex as maybe you thought that it would be before you started studying it? I know a lot of people are just scared to death. Well, I'm not fishing for a compliment, but what I'm fishing for is the simplicity of the revelation of God. Because we can read this and we can understand it. Even if you take the early date, I don't agree with that position, but even if you take the early date, there's something you can come away from this study with. And Daphne, you've repeatedly made that observation in previous studies. That we can see that yes, there was an application of this to those people then, but we can come away with a very valuable lesson. And that is the things that God has promised he will do, and the victory that he has promised he will do, and the defeat that God has promised he will do. His wrath will be executed. And that's the take home lesson from this study. I know that especially when I was very young, you think about studying the book of Revelation, oh man, you just go nuts because, well, no way we can study that and come away with anything. Well, you can. You can learn some things from a study of the book of Revelation, valuable things, and we don't really need to be afraid of the book, afraid to study it. Yes, Carolyn, I didn't see you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's
okay. You're good at noticing hands.
To me, the biggest thing is realizing how often people go back and forth between, oh yes, it's spiritual. Oh, but this little piece right here, this is something real. Oh, but this part's spiritual, but then this is something, this leader that's real or whatever. I think that's the biggest thing that I see, having been in some error-filled studies long, long ago, is they cherry pick.
Yeah.
This part's spiritual, but this part must be something real. I think that's a huge pitfall that a lot of people fall into.
Agreed. And when you look at this book as a unique book in the New Testament, it's not a unique book to the Bible. It's unique in the New Testament. But unfortunately, our familiarity with other books of the Bible that use this kind of language is somewhat vague. We've not studied carefully such Old Testament books like Daniel or Ezekiel that use this kind of language. And so we just jump right in, and I don't know how many Bible studies I've had with people that perhaps had not even read the Bible at all, or perhaps had not even read the New Testament, but they've heard about the book of Revelation, and they have some kind of a theory in mind about the application of it to the second coming of the Lord, and here's somebody that hasn't even read the New Testament, and they want to study the book of Revelation, first thing out of the chute. And, the Apostle Peter said concerning some of the things that the Apostle Paul wrote that they were hard to be understood. Not that they're impossible to be understood, but hard to be understood. They can be understood with study, and then to jump right into something that's difficult is just foolish. It's just foolish. So anyway, before I close our study, I'm sorry, Bruce.
Yeah, when you look at the whole thing, especially Revelation, it's pretty powerful, because when you start reading it in its context and the way that we're supposed to look at it, that's spiritual, it brings a comfort because now we know that we have something better. And all of this stuff has been talked about. It's been prophesied, and all the symbols and everything, you know, in which we see really aren't superficial like we've heard in the past. It's a matter of understanding, you know, and listening to what God's word is saying. And I appreciate, you know, not only you, Mickey, but also appreciate a lot of the comments that we've been making, because it tells me that we're getting to the point, we are to the point where we're understanding the love of God and the love of one another, and that we do have a God who's going to succeed in the end.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, before we close, do I see any other hands? Again, we don't want to close this session or any other without inviting those who might need our prayers or need to obey the gospel to call upon us to assist you in any way that we can to do that. So if you're present and you know what your spiritual status is better than anybody else, if you need to obey the gospel, we'll be happy to help baptize you into Christ. If you'd like the prayers of the brethren here on your behalf to help you overcome something, then we're happy to try to pray with you and for you to that end.